So now, Harvey, the stage is yours.
Well, I'm doubly pleased to be with you this morning because I know you haven't heard enough from your counsel yet. So I get to do it again. You know, the last time we did this fiduciary education session was, I think, the last time we were all together in the boardroom. So this is a very different experience trying to engage, and I don't want this to be a talking head situation. I'll go through some slides and stuff, but I want to spend a little bit of time engaging. If you have any questions or just comments or things that you're grappling with or want a little more understanding on, let's talk about that. This is more, I'd like to have this more as a workshop than a lecture, if you will, and that'll work. I've thrown a couple of hypotheticals at you. We even gave them to you in advance so you could be thinking about them. So nobody, in the past, I like to surprise people and, you know, call on you, but that's a more difficult thing. So why don't I, I'm not sure if it's Christine or whoever that will permit me to share my screen, and I'll pull the slides up. And then since they were in the background materials, oh, there we go. I can share. Let's see. I'm not finding my screen. Let me go. You can't see anything there other than a GoToMeeting.
Yeah, we can see your screen. It may be down towards the bottom on the bar. It looks like you have a bar that's minimized. So it's not all the way, it's to the left of that one. No, right next to it, but to the left. One over. And it's red. But two over, right there.
How's that?
Good.
How do we do? Can you see that?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, it's January 27th, so we don't need to spend much time on slide one. Going to slide two. So listen, just to get us grounded, because the rest of the conversation stems from these fundamental fiduciary duties. And over time, I've tried to give them to you in one slide and a synopsis. You can take this and print it and put it up on your refrigerator or anywhere else you'd like. These are fundamental fiduciary responsibilities of all of, not only the trustees, not only our board members, but staff, and whether you like it or not, I'm a fiduciary to you as well, and a fiduciary to the system. So all of us are operating under these fundamental concepts that date back hundreds of years in the law of fiduciaries. Last year, I think I spoke with you about, you know, why do we have these rules? And the real, you know, it comes down to a very simple proposition. If you're taking care of your own affairs, you have a lot of latitude about, you know, what you do, because you can exercise your own good judgment and taking care of your own affairs. Where you're trusted with taking care of somebody else's well-being and somebody else's affairs, somebody else's economic well-being, the law wants you to know that you operate within certain chalk lines and obligations. And that's really what these are all about. These are not only old concepts, essentially, in common law and general law, but they're also written into the state constitution and in our governing law, the county retirement law. So this is what's imposed on you because you are taking care of other people's well-being. And kind of quickly going through them, I mean, the fundamental duty is the duty of loyalty, the primary duty. That is, when you walk into this room, literally or figuratively, we are all obligated to recognize that we do so for all the members and their beneficiaries of the trust, whether they are active, whether they're retired, whether they're deferred, today, tomorrow. This is the primary obligation, is to look out for their well-being. Part of looking out for their well-being is to use the assets of the system exclusively for their benefit, not for other purposes, and only to incur reasonable administrative expenses. That, of course, is a judgment call, but I can tell you in the ERISA side of the world, the private company defined benefit side, that there is a constant flow of litigation against trustees over what are reasonable administrative expenses and what are not reasonable expenses, reasonable fees to pay to outside providers, reasonable costs of administering the system. This is a big area of current litigation in the ERISA field. That hasn't really come to our public pension fund, certainly not in California, although elsewhere I've had to face it with some state funds. But we have to keep in mind that the assets are there to pay the benefits and not to be diverted for other purposes. Generally, much like corporate directors who have the business judgment rule to guide them in exercising their judgment, you have a prudent expert rule. And this is more than just being a prudent person. This means that you have an obligation to educate yourself over the things that you are deciding and deliberating on. That it was 100 years ago by now, some court said, it's not enough to have a good heart, but an empty head. You're obligated when you perform these duties of trustees to have educated yourself on the items that you're charged with being the steward for. And so that requires you to get the expertise yourself. If you can't do that, you have to go out and get the expertise. It allows you to hire consultants and those to really give you a solid grounding in all things from investment expertise to actuarial expertise. All of this aimed at prudently stewarding the fund to assure that the assets meet the liabilities of the trust. The fourth one here, diversifying investments. You wouldn't think this is not something that is written into old common law of fiduciaries, but it's written into the state constitution. And essentially, the people of the state of California, in their great wisdom, of course, have decided that to run a defined benefit plan, you should subscribe to the concept of the modern portfolio theory, which is diversifying the portfolio along the so-called expected efficient frontier, and to basically own the market, unless it's clearly not prudent to do so, but basically to diversify that to assure the best risk-adjusted returns over the long term. Some people could, this is where it's very easy for outsiders to say, well, gee, in any given year, if you had just invested in the S&P 500, you could have made 13 or 15 or 19%. Why didn't you just invest in the S&P 500? Well, your charge is to diversify the investments, and that's across not only equity markets, but the debt markets as well, and not only in California, but public companies and private enterprises across the globe. That is a full diversified portfolio, and that's your charge as a fiduciary responsibility. As I say, some people could disagree with that, but I think it's often when the markets, when the equity markets are booming, it's very easy for critics to look to our pension boards and say, if you had only invested passively in the S&P 500, you could have made a lot of money. Well, live by the sword, die by the sword. the S&P is volatile. And finally, you know, we have to keep in mind that as a tax qualified plan, that the IRS demands certain things as well from us as our fiduciary responsibility, which is to follow our plan document. Plan documents change from time to time, as you know. And so your plan document are all the laws and policies and regulations that you adopt. That is, again, an obligation that's imposed on us as trustees. And if we're out of compliance with our plan documents, we have an obligation to put ourselves back into compliance so as not to jeopardize our tax qualified status and lead to the taxation of our gains and the contributions that our members make to the system. So that's it. I mean, if I could just give you this sheet and send you away, you'd be fully educated on fiduciary duties. But I want to talk a little bit about the application of how this works. And I tried to construct in the next slides, which is slide 3, I try to set these up on pillars, essentially, and kind of line up some of the things that you engage in on a regular basis under the particular pillar that they relate to. I don't want to go over each of these bullet points, but let's just take an example under the pillar, the first one of primary loyalty to members. This is where we focus so much on avoiding conflicts of interest, avoiding wearing two hats, admonishing you when you walk into the room that when you come here, it doesn't matter who put you on the board, whether you were appointed, whether you were elected, whether you're a retiree, whether you're the treasurer of the county. When you walk in here, you wear one hat, and that's the hat of trustee of this pension fund. Difficult to do, of course, but something that we have to keep returning, and that's part of the duty of loyalty. Some of the other things that aren't as obvious as duty of loyalty to the members are things like superior member service. I mean, we're in the business of delivering benefits to our membership. That's pretty much it, and figuring out how to fund those benefits. But delivery of benefits is our mission. And our loyalty to the members is to make it possible for them to navigate what otherwise is a ridiculously complex law that impacts their futures in remarkable ways. And our staff is there to provide superior member service as part of our fiduciary responsibility as trustees to we're not doing it ourselves, you're not administering the system, but to retain superior individuals with excellent skills and a real commitment to providing superior member service, part of the primary loyalty that we have to members. Of these obligations, it's the your code, you have basically taken these fiduciary responsibilities and embedded them into, and one of the best codes of fiduciary conduct and ethics that I've seen up and down the state. It's a succinct statement. I think we've attached it as an exhibit, as we always do, to the presentation. These are not by design, but by coincidence. There are 10 that I've listed here. These are the 10 commandments, so to speak, of your code. And these are the things, these are the succinct obligations that you adopt. I commend you to read these every once in a while. Use them as a talisman for the conduct that you engage in on the board. Adhering to your fundamental duties, obey conflict laws, avoid activities that improperly influence your judgment. or that are inconsistent with your duty to act in the best interests of the fund. Conflicts of interest is probably, we'll talk about that in a minute, is probably the most serious infringement of your fiduciary responsibilities. And conflicts come from having business interests that can be affected by your decisions. It can come from pressure that's brought to bear on you by those who consider them to be your constituents. It can come from accepting gifts from people that do business with the system. There's any number of ways that conflicts of interest can derail you from your solemn obligation to properly steward this fund. So you just need to be sensitized to those things when they come up. And I tried to, in the hypotheticals we'll get to, I tried to lay out a couple of examples. Some of these are real life examples from other systems, so that you get a sense of what you need to be sensitive to and spotting a conflict when it arises. I can tell you from time to time over the long time I've been involved with retirement boards that number nine here is probably the best way to achieve everything else that you're responsible for as a board member. There has been time, whether on this board and certainly on other boards, where board members were challenged, shall we say, by the inability to respect each other and show civility to each other. We have too much of an example of that at the national level. This board's done a really good job of maintaining the civility and respect that for each other that a collective board needs to maintain. You know, if the controller of the state of New York runs the New York Common Fund, it's a $200 billion pension fund, it's the third largest in the country, and it's run by one guy, the controller of the state of New York. We're in a different situation. We have to administer the fund as a collective whole. And in order to accomplish that, in order to be able to make collective judgments of nine voting members at any given time, if you don't conduct yourself in this particular way, it's almost impossible to assure that you can carry out the business of the fund. It just gets in the way. And I can tell you from other experiences in other states, which I could regale you with over a beer sometime, that where boards are uncivil to each other, board members, and conduct themselves with little respect for each other's opinion and judgment, no business gets done. None at all. All they do is fight. So this is a big part of the conduct that you're held to such a high level in the job that you have. We're talking about conflicts a little bit more, and I focus on this on slide five because it really is the most serious of all fiduciary responsibilities, avoiding these conflicts of interest. Every decision you make, whether it's engaging in a contract or hiring consultants, managers, decisions that affect litigation, for example, these can all collide with your personal interests or the interests of others who then will try to influence your judgment on these things. Exercising independent judgment unaffected by your own personal interests in anything particular is absolutely essential to the conduct of a fiduciary trustee over a pension fund. I will tell you that the rules are complicated. The Fair Political Practices Commission has multiple regulations that are very granular, how much dollars per year you can accept in gifts from anybody who's doing business with the system. My hat's always off to people like Supervisor Anderson, who have to negotiate their way through the state laws and regulations on campaign contributions and running for office. That would be probably the one thing that would deter me from ever running for public office. It's just being terrified that I took afoul of one of these rules. But I point this out only because we can't expect each trustee of the system to have in mind every single rule that governs their potential conflicts of interest. And because there are severe penalties for breach of fiduciary duty, for acting in a conflict of interest situation, all I can do is encourage you, pick up the phone, call Karen, call me, call Gail or Christine, talk to somebody about a situation that arises that where you think there may be a conflict of interest. And we can drill down with you on the specific regulation that might apply and help you navigate through this minefield because the consequences are too severe, not only to yourself personally, but to the system. I mean, if you have an undisclosed conflict of interest on a contract that the board is approving, and it turns out later that you had this conflict of interest, it's not only that you're facing sanctions for having that conflict, it would nullify the contract, it would void the contract, and it would require whoever you hired to give back all the money they got under the contract. So an undisclosed conflict of interest has consequences that far outweigh perhaps the money that may be involved. But this is the way that the people of the state have decided they want you to conduct yourself when you are responsible for other people's livelihoods and other people's economic benefits. Okay, so it's tough love. Speaking of who you're responsible for and responsible to, I wanted to graphically on slide 6 to, you know, we use this phrase a lot. We talk about our stakeholders and how we want good relations with our stakeholders and people who have a stake. But I want to use this graphic to really refocus our attention on who we're responsible to at heart, because laser beamed, the target, the bullseye of our responsibilities are to the members and beneficiaries of the system. There's no question that as you move out of that bullseye, there's no question that there are other stakeholders with important interests in how we conduct our business. But for the focus of your duties, it's the members and beneficiaries who should get your primary, almost exclusive attention. To be sure, we need to be cognizant of our contributing employers. The county and the districts provide important funding to the system. Obviously, the system doesn't work without their participation and their ability to continue to make contributions to pay the future liabilities of their employees, but they're not our primary responsibility. Retiree organizations are also important because they speak collectively for a number of our members and beneficiaries, but they are not, as an organization, they're not our focus. We're always going to be mindful of the impact that whatever it is we're doing has on the general public and taxpayers, but again, they're not our key focus. And finally, there's a lot of stakeholders that are your vendors and unions, for example, consultants, others, all of whom have an interest in what we do, but it is not our job to make them happy or to have their interests primarily in mind. So that's just a graphic representation to kind of focus our attention on every time we have a decision to make, we need to bring ourselves back to that core focus, which is, who are we doing this for, and what is their collective interest in what we're doing? You ready for hypothetical? Now, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like the board members to unmute their not their microphone, but your cameras, so I can see you. Come on, you know who you are. Dr. McDonald can't be the only board member left here. Do I have you all? I've got so many people in here, I can't see everybody.
Wait, we can see you, Harvey.
Well, that's nice.
One of my cameras is on.
Okay. Like, yeah, I'm having a hard time seeing who's on. But anyway, let's run through a hypothetical, because this is where you get to give me some feedback on what you think is appropriate under the circumstances. So our hypothetical one, this is on slide 7 for those at home. We have a registered investment advisor named Kamala. I don't know where I got that name from. It just kind of popped into my head one day. I thought that would be a good hypothetical name. Kamala is a registered investment advisor who works for a large national brokerage firm. She was recently appointed to the retirement board because she had investment expertise. Under the board's policy, staff is responsible for conducting manager selection on the advice of the investment consultant. This is very frustrating to Kamala. Remember, she's a registered investment advisor. She's frustrated with this arrangement. She believes her fiduciary duty requires her to be more hands-on. She was probably listening to her fiduciary counsel saying that you need to be an expert in what you do. So she wants to do several things now that she's new to the board. She wants to participate with staff in conducting due diligence. A ride along, if you will. She wants to meet with prospective managers and put them on her own personal approved list and then be able to recommend them to staff for later consideration. She wants to meet with the fund's hedge fund managers and really understand their strategies so she can boost returns for her clients. Why not take advantage of what she can learn from this position? She wants to meet with the board's investment consultant outside of board meetings. And she'd like to really talk to her colleagues, other board members, about changing the investment policy statement procedures that delegate manager selection to staff. And so she comes to you, Dr. McDonald, as board chair for some advice. And tells you that these are the things that she'd like to do. What are you going to tell her?
Well, I would say that participating with staff in conducting manager due diligence is good. But the rest of this kind of, for example, learning about fund manager strategy so she can boost returns for her clients is not kosher.
Let me ask you about that one. Shouldn't she be able to take advantage of what she learns as a board member? I mean, she can't wipe that out of her head. She could learn a lot of things that could be useful in her private practice.
Well, but she herself is not to profit in that way from her activity on the board. So, and then it could get a little mixed up if she's learning all of this for the sake of improving her clients' returns. Then she's lost focus of who she's really there for, and that is our members and retirees.
She can't be a board member and chew gum at the same time.
She needs to be there for the members first and foremost. And I think being better educated so that she can make decisions on whether or not to go with a certain investment or manager or whatever, as it would relate to improving investment returns for the system and boosting our ability to pay the pensions, I think that is the priority.
Well, let's go back to this, the first one there, participating with staff, and it's kind of the ride along. She wants to go on manager due diligence with staff. Anybody have a, that seems to be okay with you.
Yeah, actually, I've done that myself, and I found it to be helpful. So if we're the ones who are kind of the ultimate word on whether or not we approve of an investment or manager, and the buck stops with us, I feel a lot more comfortable making that decision if I've had the opportunity to visit those people and get an idea of how they think, how they conduct their business, so forth. It makes me feel more comfortable about making that decision instead of simply just, you know, being a rubber stamp. So I think that that's reasonable.
Jerry, what do you think about that?
I'm sorry, did you call on me?
I did.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, my reaction first to this is Kamala should stick to her day gig in DC. And she's, there's serious question in my mind as to how she actually got appointed to this board and how her employer allowed her to be, because it seemed like two big problems. And she's a Lone Ranger, acting like a Lone Ranger. She's got conflicts of interest all over the place. And this is a train wreck waiting to happen. Other than that, it's fine.
Okay, I can't see others. Anybody else want to weigh in on whether this is really a train wreck? I mean, that's pretty harsh, Jared. Just go speak out. I can't call on you because I can't see anybody on my screen.
I think becoming more familiar with how how staff is doing it is a good thing. But if the policy is that staff is supposed to do it, there's a difference between educating yourself on how they're doing it and then getting involved in the process. And if she wants to do the latter, she should bring a motion before the board to change their policy on it.
Well, you know, she's trying to do that. The last bullet point, she's trying to talk to members, other board members, about changing the procedures. Anything wrong with that?
Yeah, serial conversations for the Brown Act, which we're going to talk about in a minute.
Serial? Well, she just wants to talk to other individuals. You mean board members, you can't talk to each other?
Not serially on the same.
Not serial, one after another, to avoid the open meeting policies.
That's unfair. You read ahead.
I'm sort of jumping on Jerry's point, but loyalty first to the members does not appear to be her driving goal, and so when you get down to the third bullet, for example, the goal would appear to be that she's looking for new ideas to improve her own business prospects, perhaps with somebody else, but Nonetheless, the loyalty side is not particularly comfortable. We certainly right now encourage board members in major acquisitions to be part of the due diligence process. So that by itself seems to me to be perfectly reasonable. She clearly wants to take it a step beyond that. Meeting with the managers and investment consultants outside and coming up with her own approved list all strike me as way beyond the role of a board member. Anyway, my quick reactions.
Just a quick question there. On the third bullet point, is the problem with that just the second half of that sentence? If you met with the hedge fund managers and learn more about their strategies, but claim to do so for the benefit of the plan, is there an issue?
Well, let's talk about that. Is Scott on board here? I don't see you.
I'm here.
Do you have any sense that meeting that, you know, she can independently meet with the hedge fund managers if her stated goal is to learn more about what they do?
So, yeah, well, you just introduced the term independently. I think to the extent that she met with hedge fund managers as part of staff's due diligence for a manager to learn about their strategies, I'm tending to see it Jay's way, that if you put a period there, it's really tantamount to the first bullet, right? But it, once you qualify that and disclose her intent, which is so that she can, you know, figure out a way to boost returns for her clients, then her fiduciary obligations are all a sounder, right? She's not doing it for the fund, she's doing it for her clients. So, I mean, to me, that's the distinction. I wouldn't have trouble with any board member meeting with fund managers so long as it was part of the fund's due diligence process, the ride along. I've gotten a lot out of that. Sounds like David has as well. So so far so good. I think once it turns the corner and the intent is because she's trying to boost returns for her clients and doesn't, you know, give a damn about the fund, that's what's wrong with that picture, it seems to me.
So is the board comfortable with leaving it up to an individual board member to decide what their intent, their personal intent is as to whether this is good? Did anybody see any downside with individual board members meeting with system managers, investment managers on their own?
I'm sorry. At the, we'll be at conferences or other meetings and so forth, and of course we're going to be approached by various fund managers, and you know, hearing what they have to say, whatever is, I think fine. But I always redirect those managers to Tim, our CIO, if they're wanting to get Cesera involved in their fund, then they need to go through the investment team. But, you know, just hearing about what they do, I think is, we're gonna hear it anyway. So I think it's okay.
Other comments?
I agree with David. Conferences and managers come up to you when they talk to you about their products and stuff. But like David says, I mean, I tell them also, hey, if you're interested again, you need to talk to Jim about if you want to be in a search or whatever. And the same thing with being with the board consultants outside of board meetings. I mean, usually when we do that, it's usually the consultant is at a meeting saying he wants to meet with everybody, say for asset allocations, and we do that individually, but it's approved by the board.
Why do you think outside consultants and managers want to meet with you one-on-one?
They want to influence you.
Really?
Sure, they want your business.
So they seem to think that a way to get themselves a leg up on their competitors is to meet with you one-on-one. The question is, as a board, should you entertain that as an option for your board members to make themselves available in that fashion?
I don't think so. This is probably a little bit of an odd parallel, but one of the rules of thumb in grand jury proceedings is that when you go out and do interviews, you never do an interview by yourself. You always take someone else with you, so that when there are potential conflicts about what went on during the interview, you have someone else there to say, no, that's not what was asked, and that wasn't what was answered. The key part for this woman, in this case, Ms. Kamala, is that she wants to do so many things by herself. I want to meet with the manager. I want to have them on my approved list, I want to learn about the strategies so that they can boost her clients' returns. I want to meet with board member consultants outside of board meetings, and I want to talk with individual board members, probably one-on-one, about changing the IPS procedures. This is just clearly a way to control the flow of information, and it's a dangerous policy.
So it sounds like the board thinks generally that this particular board member, although was hired for her, what she could bring to the board, that, you know, she's cowboying, if you will, on her own a little bit too much and creating some jeopardy for the board and for the system that would best be avoided. Would that fairly summarize that?
Correct.
I'd like to see what kind of lobbying she did to get herself put onto the board.
No, you wouldn't.
Sausage.
Just a quick question then for counsel. If there was a board member, say, who seemed to be crossing the line, what would be the remedy?
Well, the board is really a self-policing entity. Now, you don't have sanction rights. You don't have the ability, for example, to remove somebody from the board. You haven't been given that power. But the board has an obligation to educate its members on the proper fiduciary standards and conflicts and personal interest standards and those sort of things. And then to try to assure compliance with them. So I would say, as a board member, if you got wind that some of this stuff was going on by another board member, you would want to escalate it first to that board member to find out what the truth was and the realities are. And then if it persisted, to bring it to the attention of the board so that the board could mitigate the risk that this person is putting the system in. That's really what we're talking about. The failure to come, a lot of times there'll be a failure to comply with fiduciary responsibilities, but there won't be, unless there's full disclosure, it's impossible to try to assure compliance. Unless somebody tells you that you're about to hire a manager that they own 10% of the stock in, you have an obligation to disclose that to your colleagues if you've got a personal financial interest in something like that. Otherwise, you're putting your colleagues in the system in jeopardy of taking on a risk to the business of the system that they don't know about. And so disclosure is incredibly important among trustees. And then some actions towards self-policing and assuring compliance is very important. You fill out Form 700 on investments, for example, investments in banking and that sort of thing. To every year, we're coming up on it this year. to try to get some handle on, do you have any interest that could step across the line and influence your personal judgment? A lot of systems really fall down on gathering that information and checking to see if it does pose real conflicts. Part of the problem with that is that the Form 700s, for example, are filed with some other filing officer, sometimes in the county, for example, and not with the system itself. And so there's just an impossible disclosure situation, a failure to disclose. So the board can self-police, but it has to have a method for getting the information and having knowledge about a situation before it can then go about trying to get compliance with this standards. Why don't we move on to hypothetical number two, now that we've warmed up on this one, and see what you think about that. And I will tell you, although it's not a Searle system, I represent another system in which this is a true story. Searle system is 51% funded. That's not so good. The board is afraid the system is no longer actuarially sound and desperately wants the county to issue a pension obligation bond to pay off the unfunded liability. They're looking for support from the Board of Supervisors to issue a POB. An influential supervisor sits on the retirement board. Now the county wants something too. The county wants the board to split its safety members off from other districts' members that happen to be in the same rate group to reduce their contributions. So the supervisor proposes a deal to you as the chair of the retirement board. You get the board to split the rate groups, and the county will issue the POB. That'll help save the system's funding. The supervisor assures you that he has already talked with the three other county appointees, and they are good to go. Who wants to take this as chair? Supervisors come to you and said, we're ready to rock and roll with this deal that will help ensure the funding of the system.
Maybe you should start a recall petition for that supervisor by violating a few laws, and Brown Act, quid pro quo, a few other things like that.
That's so harsh, Candace.
It's so harsh. But no, when I read this fact pattern, I really thought you made it up, Harvey, because it was almost comical that someone would really go to that that level or not have a really keen understanding of what needs to happen. You know, perhaps if the Board of Supervisors had met in open session and talked about the fact that it would make sense as they go through their budget to see if safety could somehow be separated, depooled, maybe then you could get around some of that Brown Act, because then she could say in open session, we had this discussion. It was part of our budget discussion about how we were going to fund our unfunded liabilities. And this came up. Yeah, maybe you could get around this, but I have serious issue with the deal. I'm not a big fan.
No, you're just saying paper this thing over to make it, you know, walk through the hoops, but the ultimate deal, do you have a problem with the ultimate deal? It's gonna fully fund the retirement system.
Yeah.
Both the supervisor who sits on this board and the board chair have their primary obligation to provide for an actuarially sound retirement system.
Yeah.
Who cares how you got there?
Yeah, you're wearing different hats, absolutely. So gotta be wearing your retirement board hat, regardless if you're a supervisor.
Well, let's take the chair. Isn't the chair keeping the best interests of the members and beneficiaries in mind?
Yeah, I mean, again, you really can't legally make those kinds of deals. So that's where I have the problem. It's the quid pro quo.
Anybody want to comment on the benefits of this deal?
Well, one of the things that jumps out to me, Harvey, and I think I understand this to be the case, is that by reducing the cost to the county, you're increasing the cost to other entities, not very clearly described. To some degree, in Confire versus East Fire, that's the kind of world we looked at, not in this context, of course, but the cost went up on one side and down on the other. And we had to make an equity decision on which one we supported. Here we're talking about the county winning and the other governmental entities losing. That just seems inherently.
John, isn't the real winner the members and beneficiaries? Why are you caring about the contributing employers so much?
You mean the county, as opposed to the other employers?
Yeah. What do you care about them if you're fully funding the benefits for the members and beneficiaries?
But aren't you? It seems to me the board chair owes his or her fiduciary responsibility to the system, the fund, and it's inappropriate to cross over. Essentially, advocating a POB is crossing over into the employer realm of how it funds its agency contribution to the fund, and that's outside the scope of not only the duty of loyalty but responsibility and legal right, I would think.
Let's be realistic. The chair knows that there's no damn well that the county can contribute enough to get from 51% funded ratio. The only way to do it is a POB.
Well, the members that you have the loyalty requirement to include those who are going to be the losers on this arrangement.
Who would that be, John?
The group that by splitting your group into two, the county ends up having a lower cost. Just as East County or East Fire had a lower cost, that lower cost was made up by a higher cost to Confire. I assume that this was, I say it's not clear to me completely who the other entities are. It's just there are other entities because the cost of the plan doesn't change. It's just who's bearing it.
Isn't the overriding goal of fully funding the system just outweigh that kind of splitting hairs about contribution?
I would tell you that if you did it all openly in your board, that's a reasonable argument. But it was done openly, not by three or four of you working it out on the side.
So the means would justify the ends. If they were good beans.
You just have to get the losers to agree.
Does everybody think that this is a real problem here? When there's a possibility of fully funding the system, shouldn't we sweep the other technical problems aside?
I could fully fund myself if I robbed the bank, but that wouldn't necessarily, be a good end for the means.
So why do you have to make those changes? Why not just do the POB? Why do you have to have contingencies on that?
From the county, it's a fiscal trade-off.
The county's making money.
Contributions down, they can use the contributions to pay the debt service on the POB. It's a win-win for the county. It's a win-win for the pension fund. John's worried about these other little districts
that we have a loyalty to because they're in the plan.
Rusty, what do you think about this? You keep popping up a little bit.
Well, in the case of the POB, there's no guarantee it's going to be financially sound. And in fact, it could be a losing deal for the county, which could hurt them down the road and make matters worse as the source of funding to the serial system. So I don't know if I would agree with even issuing the POB unless I looked at the trade-offs there, whether or not, again, the county would come out ahead as well as the serial system. And then again, to the point of splitting off the safety members, it seems like, again, you're sidestepping your loyalty to the entire membership of the serial system and putting them in harm's way down the road, making matters harder for them to support their own retirement funding. So I wouldn't go along with this.
This is the kind of thing that is not far-fetched that's coming up these days. You know, just from general literature and reading the paper, that a lot of systems, particularly in California, the ones who are participating sponsors, the cities and the districts in CalPERS, are considering issuance of POBs and rolling the dice in the market. On its face, it appears to be a real boon to the retirement system, but there are often quid pro quos, if you will, pluses and minuses to be considered. Tough decision for boards to identify their fiduciary responsibilities on, setting aside the obvious setup here, which is the Brown Act violation. That's just, you know, icing on the cake in my hypothetical. But there are some very difficult things that boards are grappling with these days that really do test their commitment to fiduciary principles, which takes me to slide 9. Here's some of the hot button issues that are coming up that, you know, whether they come to Contra Costa County or not, these are things that are impacting systems and really testing their fiduciary responsibilities now. Funding decisions, we just talked about the POB. You know, we've got a lot of systems that are stubbornly 70% or less funded, and regardless of the markets, that they're not moving the ball towards fuller funding. It just, for whatever reason, because of different actuarial changes and assumptions, they're not getting more fully funded. So a lot of pressure to bring in a lot more money, and that's been made more difficult during the COVID era. So we have a lot of balancing plan sponsor budgets with their ability to fully fund the benefits. Another issue that we've talked about is pretty obvious up and down the state, complying with the Supreme Court precedent that requires us to make decisions in the members' interests, despite what appears that the decision went against members' interests. A lot of systems are grappling with delegation of authority to staff because of the complexity of whether it's investments or IT or risk mitigation. That's a big issue, and trying to understand what it means to have nose in and fingers out, if you will. Direct oversight of consultants. Manager fees is a big issue. Some of our systems are dealing with the fossil-free movements, for example, and diversity and inclusion among their managers. So ESG issues are coming up at all and really testing boards' commitment to and definition of what their fiduciary responsibility is to consider climate change impacts, those kind of impacts on the value of their portfolios. Staff compensation is always an issue, but especially during a period when there are layoffs and furloughs, and then there's always pressure from your colleagues. So in thinking about these things and dealing with these as fiduciary counsel, What I really want to leave you with is more of a methodology than the original pillars of fiduciary responsibilities. And on slide 10, I've created five new fiduciary pillars. And they are more about your personal behavior as a trustee, as opposed to what the rules for the fiduciaries are. And they are simply that, you know, I encourage you to act with integrity, fairness, balance between the interests of your members, act prudently, and recognize that you're a collective board, and so you have to achieve the goals of the system through teamwork. So these are what I would leave you with personally as conduct pillars, if you will, and how to best meet. If you follow these conduct pillars, you will meet your responsibilities as a fiduciary in the system. And I'm going to leave you with that. You've heard enough from me for the day. Are there any questions or comments, anything anybody wants to talk about before we turn this back over to Scott? And I can't see everybody, so just shout out if you have anything on your mind. Put you all to sleep. Okay, Scott, back over to you. Thanks, everybody, for participating in this exercise.
I think you meant Todd. But
oh, did I say, what did I say, Scott?
Scott. Scott's oh, my cat.
Yeah, it's okay. I felt important for like a moment. It was good.
No, my cousin, Scott. So it's the same thing my grandparents do. So you're in good company. Thank you, Harvey.